Welcome to the Symphony Space in New York City. I'm John Donvan, your host and moderator for this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, another in a series of, we hope, smart and scintillating programs debating topics that matter. The motion before us, major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. This is a contest. It's a contest of logic and wit and mostly persuasion. These panelists are here to change your minds. You, the audience, are the judges. Now, we want to ask you at this point to register your views on this motion as you come in off the street before hearing any of the argument, because as I say, they are here to persuade you and to change your minds. So let's let the debate begin. Our motion is major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. And arguing first for the motion, Bjørn Lomborg, he is from Denmark, the land that has led the globe in the development of wind power. It is an environmentalist's dreamland. But he is an environmentalist skeptic in many ways and is first to argue for the motion.
I'll speak for the motion that major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. Let's be clear, global warming is real. But the brutal fact is that even major carbon cuts at dramatic cost will make little impact on temperature and do virtually nothing to help the world. Still, my honored opponents will spend hundreds or even thousands of billions of dollars to slightly reduce the impact of climate change 100 years from now. Today, 1 billion people lack clean drinking water, 2 billion people lack sanitation, 3 billion people lack simple micronutrients. As an example, 1 million people die from malaria each year, yet my esteemed opponents will focus on how global warming will cause a slight increase in malaria occurrence 100 years from now. But we could eradicate malaria right now if we wanted and at a lot lower cost. That is the moral choice. Of course, the obvious and easy thing is to say, well, we should do all good things. We should both make major carbon reductions and combat malaria. But this simply ignores the fact that we aren't doing either very well. We avoid the hard truth that the rich world's focus is shifting daily towards global warming, with proportional less support seen for other real and more tractable problems. Any company or organization today that wants to appear responsible, even just cool, will not be spending their cash in fighting tuberculosis, but wants to go carbon neutral. At the Copenhagen Consensus Project last year, a panel of the world's most distinguished economists looked at a wealth of research of all the major problems in the world and the possible solutions to them. They agreed that global warming is real, and they were unanimous that the best way to tackle it is by investing much more in research and development in low-carbon energy technologies. The economists also found that carbon emission cuts, tonight's motion, would be the poorest use of our money. I commend this motion to you. Do what's rational, not what's just fashionable. Thank you.
If Kyoto was the treaty that was supposed to slow the growth of greenhouse gases, it has failed, and Oliver Tickell has come up with Kyoto 2, an environmental blueprint. Environment is his passion, and he is next arguing against the motion. Ladies and gentlemen, Oliver Tickell.
Bjorn did an excellent presentation, and he made very effective use of a particular rhetorical flourish, which I would call the false choice. Either we address the problem of global warming, or we address the problems of malaria, water provision, and malnutrition. This is a false choice. No one's saying that we've got to do one or other. We can do both. It is no more real a choice than that between tackling global warming and eating pizza. In fact, if we tackle the problems of global warming in an effective way, it will directly help with the provision of water. Now, the core point, though, actually, Bjorn very kindly began to make it for me. It is that the consequences of not dealing with global warming are potentially catastrophic. What we do know is that 55 million years ago, temperatures were 10 degrees warmer than they are now. Carbon dioxide levels were approximately 1,000 parts per million, and sea levels were approximately 250 feet higher. Now, we have been there before. We can go there again. To avoid this, you have to spend money. But If we look at the amounts of money, I mean, my costing, which includes not only mitigation, but also substantial funding for adaptation, which is already taking place, is about $1 trillion per year. And that is roughly the same as what the world spends on weaponry and the military sector. So if we can afford to spend that on weapons, why can't we afford to spend it to prevent this potentially ruinous catastrophe that could come upon us? But I will go a stage further, and I will say that actually much of this isn't really cost at all. It is investment, because we need, ultimately, to move away from fossil fuels anyway. If we move away from fossil fuels sooner, before we have to, because they run, that actually saves enormous economic cost. It saves the economic cost of $150 a barrel petrol, oil, and that is something that has caused America and other countries huge hardship. We can create new industries. We have huge idle workforces. We have huge idle productive capacity in industries that can be put back to work, building us a future free of fossil fuels. So in answer to the question, is it worth the money to make these major reductions in carbon dioxide emissions, the only possible answer is yes, and do it now.
Our motion is major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money, and now arguing for the motion, Peter Huber, an author who publishes here in the United States books with titles like The Bottomless Well, but I'd like to look at the subtitles that tell us really what he thinks. One of his books was subtitled Saving the Environment from the Environmentalists, another Why We Will Never Run Out of Energy. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Huber.
Well, while he was running, Barack Obama was heard to say that he would bankrupt our coal industry. Now, I don't doubt Washington's ability to bankrupt almost anything, but China is currently adding 100 gigs of coal electricity a year. There is no end in sight, and there are other countries all across the globe following exactly in its footsteps. We rich people of the planet can't stop the other 5 billion poor people from burning a couple of trillion tons of carbon that they have within easy reach. And if we are foolish enough, which we could well be, we will let carbon worries send our jobs to their shores, and they will grow even faster, and carbon emissions will grow faster still. Poor countries all around this planet are sitting on a trillion tons of readily accessible coal. We no longer control demand for carbon either. The 5 billion poor people are already the main problem, not us. If you have heard otherwise, you have heard wrong. Collectively, the poor already emit 20% more greenhouse gas than we do. We burn a lot more carbon individually, of course, but they have a lot more children. Their fecundity has beaten out our gluttony, and the gap is now widening very fast. China, not the United States, is now the largest emitter of greenhouse gas on the planet, and it will soon be joined by others. It's only a matter of time. So it really does come down to this. First, can we give the world something cheaper than carbon? The moonshot law of economics says, why, yes, we can. If we just really put our minds to it, it will happen. Atom bomb, moon landing, energy, you name it. No, not this time. Fossil fuels are very cheap because they concentrate a lot of energy in a small space. You find a mountain of coal and you can just shovel gargantuan amounts of energy into the boxcars. Renewable fuels like sun and wind are much harder. Windmills are now 50-story skyscrapers, yet one windmill generates a piddling 2 megawatts. China and India won't trade 3-cent coal for 15-cent wind or 30-cent solar. And if we force those expensive technologies on ourselves, we will certainly end up doing more harm than good. Frantically chasing the impossible and falling flat on your face doesn't make things better. It often makes things worse, and it's never worth the money.
Arguing against the motion, Adam Werbach. And in the 90s, Adam Werbach was the whiz kid of the environmentalist movement. At 23, he was the president of the Sierra Club. His views have evolved since then, and recently he has been consulting for Walmart. Ladies and gentlemen, Adam Werbach.
Mr. Huber, I want to thank you for your novel argument, summed up as, "No, we can't." You begin by saying you care about the world's poor, and then you start by saying the 5 billion poor people are the problem. We're going to send our jobs to their shores. They have too many children. This type of contempt will not lead us towards the world that we want to build for our kids, either here or across the world. The question at hand, and the question we face, is, are major reductions in carbon worth the money? And I'll very simply give examples at the level of the economy, at the level of a corporation, and the level of the individual. Americans spend about a week a year, if they commute a lot, stuck in their cars. That costs the economy, in terms of productivity and fuel cost, about $78 billion a year. If we invested in new traffic software and signaling, public transportation to create those green jobs that you have such contempt for, we could, in fact, reduce that. Major carbon reductions are worth the money. At the level of a corporation, more and more corporations are not just doing it because it's fashionable. They're doing it because they're building a strategy for sustainability to move them forward. Walmart made 3 commitments in its turnaround. 1, to be powered 100% by renewable energy, which would be a major reduction in carbon. 2, to produce zero waste. They pushed this down the supply chain. It pulled energy out, lowering the cost of the products, lowering the cost to the consumer. And one of the reasons a company like Walmart is doing so well right now is that they become more efficient because of a focus on major reductions in carbon. Our opponents tend to focus on the fact that we can't do everything and that there are other problems. And yes, there are other problems, and we need to work on them. For example, I could tell you tonight that there are exit signs at the back of the theater, and there's one at the side of the theater, and that's probably very important in case there were a fire. But maybe I could instead tell you about influenza, because that's the 8th largest killer in America, and it might tell you to worry about the person next to you, because they might be a little sickly. These things are all true, but we can do 2 things at once. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. And the great thing about carbon is that it's one single thread. If you pull it, the entire sweater begins to unravel. Major reductions in carbon are good for the economy and are absolutely worth the money. Thank you.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. The motion up for debate is, major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. Stay with us. Arguing next for the motion, Philip Stott, Professor Emeritus from the University of London. His specialty carries the distinct and revealing name of biogeographer. He is an expert in many things, from the nature of fire to the behavior of soil. And tonight he is arguing for the motion.
Adam and colleagues, I really wish I could believe that we can manage the costs that would control climate. Very sadly, I have to quote Samuel Johnson, the great British lexicographer. An obstinate stubbornness, a rationality, stops me believing it. And with a twinkle in my eye, because we're in New York and near Wall Street, what I want to show, very dangerously, is that climate science and these costs are subprime science, subprime economics, and above all, subprime politics. And they will cost us dear, despite what Adam and Oliver and Hunter will be saying. And we've got to be very, very careful. But I just want you to have one image, and it's a very serious scientific image. I want you to think of the world from inner Siberia to Greenland, then to Singapore, and then come to the Arab states and to Sahara. What, ladies and gentlemen, is the temperature range I have just covered? It is from minus 20 degrees C to nearly 50 degrees C, a range of 70 degrees C in which humanity has adapted and learnt to live. We are talking about, ignoring the extremes that Oliver said, a prediction of 2 to 3 degrees C. What a funk! I'm very serious. What a funk! Humanity lives successfully from Greenland to Singapore to Saudi Arabia. 70 degrees C. Climate is the most complex, coupled, non-linear, chaotic system known to man. Of course there are human influences in it. Nobody denies that. But what outcome will they get by fiddling with one variable at the margins? I'm sorry, it's scientific nonsense. They've forgotten the famous Jevons paradox. Professor Jevons from my own country, University College London, that actually when you save on energy,
You don't really save, you simply transfer it to new energy costs and actually probably issue more CO2. So when you save energy, you take another holiday, you take another flight, your CO2 increases. And he demonstrated that in the 19th century. Have we forgotten this basic economics? But it's the politics then, finally, subprime politics. We are full of eco-poseurs, and in the United States you have some gems. I don't think I need to mention them. But let me come back to Johnson again, because Johnson said everything in a very, very brilliant book that he wrote in the 18th century there called Rasselas. He talks of an astronomer who claims that he can control climate. This is what he says. The sun has listened to my dictates and passed from tropic to tropic by my direction. The clouds at my call have poured their waters. And what does Johnson say about this astronomer? He was mad. And so are we if we actually believe we can control climate predictably. The costs in every sense will be enormous. Oh, mamma mia. We are the dancing queens. Let's give this global warming nonsense its Waterloo tonight. Thank you.
Finally, speaking against the motion, I'd like to introduce Elle Hunter-Lubbins. She is the founder of Natural Capitalism, an organization whose precepts are ecologically friendly development, and research tells us that Time magazine has named her a hero of the planet. Ladies and gentlemen, Hunter-Lubbins.
Are major reductions in carbon worth the money? That's what we're debating. We're not debating whether or not we can control the climate. We're not even debating what the climate will be. We're debating, are major reductions worth the money? And that's the only question, for better or for worse, that we're going to talk about tonight. My company walked into a company that has big warehouses, about a million square feet of warehouse, and boxes stacked floor to ceiling. Every 10 feet in the ceiling were 500-watt light bulbs shining down on the tops of boxes. The guys who worked down below had task lighting so they could see where they were going. We said, y'all have a switch? $650,000 saved the first year. Now, that is not a cost to deliver major carbon reductions. Zero cost. Now, this is what's called low-hanging fruit. We could cut half the carbon in the country. Chicago Climate Exchange. This is a voluntary group of now over 400 businesses. My company is a member, who have pledged to cut their carbon. They have reduced carbon collectively 8%. There's no law that says they have to. You don't need taxes. You don't need draconian regulation. We simply need to be smart about how we use energy. California, AB 32, new study out from the University of California, fully implementing the Republican Governor Schwarzenegger's cap on carbon and trading regime, would deliver to California $78 billion in increased state gross product. So let's bring it home. Four Times Square down the road. Looks like a normal building. Costs the same to build. Uses half the energy. Gets its energy from photovoltaics in the skin of the building and a fuel cell in the basement. This building can never be turned off. So in the 2003 Northeast blackout, remember that? People came from blocks around to camp out underneath it. Genuine homeland security. If we want security, if we want an economy, we will invest in energy efficiency and renewable energy, because it's what gives us the greatest rate of return.
Hunter-Lubbins, time is up. Thank you. Thank you, Hunter-Lubbins. So where we are in the debate, the time period of uninterrupted speaking is over. We're going to move into the portion of the evening now where the debaters debate one another. And as you recall, when you came in this evening, we polled you about your view on the motion, and we will poll you again after the debate, but I have the results that have come in now. Our motion is major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. In support of this motion, 16%. Against the motion, 49%. And that leaves 35% undecided. So I'd like to now come to your questions, and what I'm going to do in the beginning is maybe collect two or three. I see down, right down front, third row.
Well, many environmental impacts, such as carbon emissions, are merely treated as externalities in terms of economic costs. Al Gore, however, suggests that these carbon emissions are treated as total economic costs. How greatly would American industries be affected if these environmental impacts were treated as costs rather than externalities?
And Bjorn, would you like to take that last question?
Yeah, and clearly I think any economist would say that we need to actually make sure that the externality, the thing that you don't pay for, that you actually end up paying for it. But you also have to have a realistic sense of it, and that's, of course, where we need to talk not just about what works in particular companies, but what actually works for economy. If you look at across all the different studies, and Professor Richard Tall has done so, and it's latest and the only global survey of all the costs of what is an extra ton of CO2 causing of damage in the world, the answer is that's about $7 per ton of CO2. That translates pretty much into 6 cents per gallon of gasoline. So yes, we should have a carbon tax. That's not what's actually going to do anything majorly for or against our emissions.
Oliver Tickell, what did you hear in that answer?
Well, I think that this whole question that of paying for externalities associated with carbon emissions is absolutely crucial. And then you get to the point of if people do pay for externalities in the form perhaps of a carbon tax or an auction price of carbon permits under a cap and trade system, what then happens to those funds that are raised? Clearly there are two ways to go. There is adaptation, there is mitigation, but the greatest of these is mitigation. Because the best way that we can serve the victims and potential victims of climate change is by making sure that it does not happen.
Philip Starr, what's this head shaking?
You're never going to stop climate change. Can we just kill one thing off? Climate will change without us or with us. And that's where Bjorn is right. Bjorn is right because always it's going to have to aid adaptation. If in any way we impoverish ourselves so we cannot help the developing world, that would indeed be a moral mistake of mammoth proportions.
Whoa, nobody's talking about impoverishing ourselves. We are talking about the generation of wealth through smart investments. Now, your question of who's going to spend the money, most of the people that are proposed to spend the money, whether it be the UN or the U.S. government or anybody's government, I think they're going to spend it badly. How about we set incentives to enable the business community to do what it is already doing, which is decarbonizing, because it's in their economic interest.
Hunter, I love the illusionist of saying, oh, this is going to be free. We are going to make money off of this. I love the fact that you want to reintroduce into the American public the idea of a profit-maximizing CEO. I think that's a good idea. But honestly, I think you already have that. The point is, how are we going to get beyond that? And that is going to be costly. And Europe has shown the way.
But Bjorn, costly, I mean, the question went to the matter of a 2% of world GNP.
Yeah.
That is enormously costly.
Yeah, and that is what the UN is telling us that the cost is probably going to be. I mean, you can have a discussion about is it going to be 1%, is it going to be 3%, but it's definitely going to be hugely costly. And simply making these stories that some companies can make money, hey, great. And presumably we don't have to do anything to make them make money. But the real question is,
please,
where are we going to get the rest of the cuts?
One of the absolute key things here is actually to address the very agenda that you put forward of huge spending into research and development for renewable technology. And the strange thing is that you put that forward as if it was some kind of an alternative to cutting carbon, when in fact it's a very important aspect of how you set about cutting carbon emissions. Where you're wrong with that, it is a necessary part but not sufficient, because there are two components. There's research and development, and then there is making sure that it happens on a sufficiently large scale to get the economies of mass production, which are real. And we know in the case of solar PV that the cost falls 20% for every doubling of production. We see in the New York Times today that the cost to Americans of installing solar PV is half of what it used to be as a result, in part, of these kind of cost savings.
Oliver, we're not disagreeing with you on that.
This is the situation that we need to bring about. And as the costs come down through research, through development, through mass production, through large-scale deployment, we are bringing costs down and we are cutting carbon emissions.
Nobody in this panel is against increasing energy efficiency and energy security. It's the most sensible thing of all. But if you're making the marker of it always what is precisely happening to carbon, A, you're not going to do it, and I'm sorry to say you're not actually going to do it for a reason I'll just mention in a second, but also the real issue is how are we going to have enough energy of all types, not just to keep the US going, but above all, from my point of view, for the developing world. That is, to me, absolutely crucial.
Good, let's talk about the developing world how you meet their energy needs.
Frankly,
We know how they're meeting their energy needs. They are taking down their rainforests, they are soaking carbon out of their land, and they are burning coal. I mean, we actually know this. All this talk about externalities, if you don't know this, the Kyoto system divides the world. I didn't do this, they did it. They divide it into 20-80, okay? Everything on the 20, nothing on the 80. How can we even talk about externalities? If I said to you, folks, we're getting an externality system worked out for this group just right here, but it's only this group here. All the rest of you do what you like. What do you think would work with that system? Nothing would work.
Interesting and totally off the point of are major cuts in carbon worth the money? Take Afghanistan, where I work. You and I and the rest of American taxpayers this winter will spend something like $80 million buying diesel to run the North Kabul power plant, that diesel trucked over the Khyber Pass. If instead we enabled the Afghans by training, by technology transfer, to grow oil crops, take the oil and make it into biodiesel, they would have a viable industry, they would have jobs, and we would not be paying for the diesel to pollute the air in Kabul. Now, yes, this would be an expenditure of money. It would enhance national security for us, and if, in fact, we don't deliver genuine development to the Afghans, we will get our heads handed
to us.
But Hunter,
what about the impact of biofuel development for this on the need, even greater need, to increase world food supply? You're taking land now increasingly for biofuels to increase world food supply. It is a competitive
choice. Only because you're doing it stupidly and because
no.
We are subsidizing it.
No.
Yeah, we are.
You are subsidizing it, but in fact, the seriousness all the way through from Malaysia, for example, to Indonesia, except the impact is potential. In fact, some people argue it is now one of the most serious pressures causing, in fact, a reduction in world food supply.
Look, I'm
at
not
a time
Bjorn,
when we have
Bjorn,
to
Bjorn Lomborg, let's have
well,
Bjorn.
I just want us to bring us back to having a conversation, and Hunter was actually very good at that. We need to get back to business. This is not about who can come up with the smartest story or the most endearing, cute little tale. This is about how can we do this in the world. And the economists have done those studies, and they have shown that this has real and significant cost on the tour of 1 to 3 or 4% of GDP.
But I think you missed the difference between a cost and an investment.
Money? Well, but the problem is it's not an investment if it doesn't actually pay back more, and that's, of course, the whole question. Are we doing a lot of good for the world?
Adam, we're back against the motion, speaking against the motion.
I enjoy the conversation. I mean, 2-3 years ago, we were arguing about whether climate change was real, and now we've moved beyond that. Now the question is, should there be a carbon cap that seems to be the right place, or should it just be investments in things that actually bring down the cost of energy for everyone? Okay, well, I agree that we should be investing and bringing down the cost for everyone. Now, then the debate is, are major reductions in carbon necessary? Do we actually need a cap as well? Well, for the companies I work with and for governments, they actually want the rules set.
But Adam,
we've seen without an effective SEC, without an effective regulatory framework, people can invest and there's no guarantee for the investment.
But Adam, your side itself isn't proposing no cap on 80% of the world that currently generates 54% of the greenhouse gases.
This is the old Kyoto system, and I don't think any of us are supporting that.
John, could we just answer the word major? If I'm being quite honest about major, to influence climate in any way, you fundamentally would have to throw 4 billion people out of work. You'd have to keep every ounce of coal in the ground. Every ounce of oil in the ground. And let's be absolutely frank, it isn't going to happen. Because the impact of anything less from changing your light bulbs to biofuels is absolutely non-existent on climate. And that's my point. If it were truly worth doing, the costs would be right. But it won't work on climate.
No, Philip, I would really like to take you up on a point here, because I think that what we're seeing here, when we began, the introduction that was given was that you, your side, accepted the fundamental reality of climate change caused by greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but all you've done is to deny it. No, both you and Bjorn.
Yes, you have. There has been a tendency to
I think, almost accuse the other side of intellectual dishonesty. Well, Philip, you used the term junk science. Adam,
you accused
Peter Huber of contempt. Bjorn, you accused Oliver Tickell of doom-mongering.
Absolutely, but I've been very nice.
Do you, in fact, Adam, do you think your other side, your opponent's arguments are intellectually dishonest?
Well, that's for them to decide in their consciences tonight. But
No, actually, it's a question to you.
But the question, I guess, I accused my opponent of contempt. And when someone says 5 billion poor people are the problem, and that was a direct quote from what he said, that is a contemptuous statement. Our job sent to their shores. That is a contemptuous statement. I think that is a fact.
Well, if anybody took a discussion of jobs as contempt, I truly apologize. I feel no contempt. I'm trying to talk about macroeconomic effects in a global economy. You know, many people feel there is a global economy and things do move like that. As for saying, you know, their fecundity has beaten our gluttony, I don't know which is ruder, to be, you know, gross and eat too much or to have lots of children, but I don't mean any contempt by it. I'm just saying it is an actual fact.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. The motion up for debate is, major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. Stay with us.
I'd like to ask the folks who are arguing against the motion, what in a legal context or an enforceability from an enforceability standpoint, would you expect that we can actually do about China, India, and the developing world?
Adam Warbeck.
Now, what type of constraints will be put on China? Well, China, obviously, is interested in that as well. And China, as it begins to invest in building these sort of renewable technologies, is going to be very interested in dealing with the air pollution, because in Chinese cities, they're very concerned about air pollution right now, and they know that comes from coal plants, and they're concerned about dealing with that. So they're highly motivated to reach the point of energy parity, or a place where everyone has enough energy, and then to ratchet down both the CO2 emissions, the air particulate matter emissions, and all those sorts of negative consequences that come from it.
Peter Huber, do you
mind? You know, there is no field of policy you will ever find, and I spent 25 years in Washington watching this, where you will find a greater gap between what people actually do and what they say they're going to do, want to do, should do, ought to do. The EU itself, the people who are most frantic about this and who signed this stuff, they're not, none of them or possibly one of them will meet their Kyoto commitments. You know, you just cannot take talk about what people are going to do for anything. China is, in fact, building coal plants like crazy, okay? They say they're going to build more, but I couldn't care less what they say. They are actually doing it. They are the world's biggest emitter today. How can you ignore the world's biggest emitter?
Well, I mean, there's a few things to remember here, and surely one key thing is that a very large part of this coal that's being burnt in China is actually producing products for export to America and to the European
Union. Creating jobs.
And so your tax are plants, but not theirs, right?
And it's important to recognize that. Another thing, let's look at what China is actually doing. China is investing hugely in renewables. China's already got the world's biggest solar and photovoltaic industries. China is investing hugely in wind turbines. They are building more and more of the world's turbines and bringing the cost of turbines down. And yes, they may indeed be mining more coal, but much of that is surely displacing imports.
On the far side.
Yeah, to my ear, those against the motion are not confronting the choices that are necessary. And it's been sort of a flagrantly anecdotal presentation. And I would suppose that, first of all, I want to say that Hunter actually said, whether she realizes it or not, during her presentation, that what they have in mind would require neither major changes in taxation or major changes in regulation. Now, if that's it, then why are we having the debate? Let's go on.
Is that your
I don't
question?
Think that's my question is
Thank
for
you.
Anyone on that side to honestly address the real trade-offs that we're talking about. If we're talking about 1 or 2 or 3% of gross international product, or whatever the other major changes are, if there aren't major trade-offs, then we shouldn't be having the debate. And I think they've been denying the trade-offs all throughout the debate.
Oliver Tickell, take
that. I have got to agree that there are trade-offs. And that there are some aspects of moving to a low-carbon economy which actually produce a net gain, your negative costs, low-hanging fruit, but there are other areas where there are real costs, at least in the short term. The important thing is that as you progress from the short term through to the medium term, you find that the investments that you're making in renewable energy technology, for example, and in mass production, developing the engineering expertise to bring costs down, that actually over the medium term, these shift from being a cost to being a benefit. And the nature of that benefit is a lot more than just the carbon. There are many, many benefits, such as air pollution. What is the world's biggest source of arsenic and mercury in the environment? It is burning coal. What do you think of the wars that are being raged in the Middle East, where the thirst for fossil fuels and oil fundamentally underlies them? There are many benefits in moving away from that kind of world into a world which is actually characterized by cooperation on energy. Because if we move large scale to renewable energy, it requires cooperation among countries with different kinds of intermittent renewables balancing out supplies over long distance grids. And that will actually fundamentally change the whole way in which countries interact with each other. It will produce not just a greener world, a cleaner world, but actually a safer world and a happier world.
Question from the front left.
One very brief question, and then another thing that I kind of want to, I'll see if I can lump them in. One thing that hasn't been addressed yet at all is peak oil, and that's going to obviously affect our economy and the demand and supply.
And for
right
people
now.
Who don't know what peak oil refers to.
Peak oil is when we've used up half of the world's oil supply, and beyond that, the rate of production slows dramatically, kind of falls off on a bell curve.
Hunter.
The International Energy Agency says expect serious constraints on the supply of oil within 2 years. The Germans think a year. It really doesn't matter. The investments that you would want to make if you were scared to death about peak oil are exactly the same investments you'd want to make if you simply want to make money, i.e. energy efficiency and then renewable energy.
Bjorn Lomborg.
Again, we need to get a sense of proportion. A lot of people are trying to sell you, oh, we can move to renewables. We can do a lot of great things. Let's just remember that the International Energy Agency, as you just mentioned, estimate that right now we use about half of 1% of our energy comes from renewables like wind and solar and geothermal. If we don't do anything by 2030, it'll be up to 1.7%. But if we really strive, if we really do everything that all this people over here on this side wants us to do, we might be able to, the International Energy Agency estimate, to squeeze it up to 2.8%. I'm sorry, that's just not going to make a big difference in this world. And that's, of course,
neither
the
are
real
those numbers
crucial
correct.
Point.
Bjorn,
well, the point is,
we can meet, the U.S. National Energy Lab showed by 2025 we could be meeting at least a quarter of U.S. energy through renewables if we simply made the intelligent
investments.
But
there was a report in 1950 that said we could do it now. I mean, how can you keep on making these sorts of comparisons?
If you include nuclear in renewables, the figures change.
Hey, I like nuclear.
Yeah,
I really do. Remotely sited, 93 million miles away, will do just fine.
The only way Britain will make its targets is very, very simple, as all the governments have known, and Tony Blair knew extremely well, is that if we do not have a new generation of nuclear power stations, there's absolutely no way we shall meet anything like a renewable target.
This concludes round two of the debate. Thank you for all of your questions, and thank you to our panel for quite seriously rising to the occasion. In a moment, we're going to do two things. Each panelist will have 2 minutes to make summary remarks. And right after that, we will be polling you to determine the winner of this debate. And I want to remind you once again of the results we received when we polled you coming in off of the street. The motion is that major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. 16% of you were in support of that motion, 49% of you were against the motion, and 35% of you were undecided. And we'll begin summing up against the motion, Oliver Tickell, journalist and author of the Kyoto 2 Climate Initiative.
Someone asked the question, at what point have we made sufficient cuts in greenhouse gas emissions? And there is, in fact, quite a clear answer to that. What we've got to do, Philip Stott is quite right when he says, we can't stop climate change. What we've got to do is to stop the runaway greenhouse effect, in which positive feedback processes in the climate system lead to an inexorable extreme warming process, turning this planet into a very different place, a hothouse Earth, one in which the limiting factor on humans isn't so much whether we can survive the temperatures, it's whether the climate system can survive these temperatures. It's whether ice caps
can survive these temperatures. Now, I think it's worth spending almost any amount of money to stop that from happening. The fantastic news is we don't have to. Actually, the costs are really quite modest in the context of the global economy, and they bring benefits which are greater than what we spend and which spread over a far wider area than simply economic benefits. They bring quality of life benefits, ecological benefits, benefits in food security, benefits in biodiversity. And so is it worth making these investments? The answer is yes, it is. And I'm very happy to know that this is actually on the verge of taking place here in the United States under the new President Obama.
Oliver Tickell, thank you very much. Making his summary remarks for the motion, Bjørn Lomborg, founder of the Copenhagen Consensus.
Thank you. It's a little depressing to see that I started out telling you that we were going to hear two arguments, and indeed we have heard them. One is that this is going to be the end of the world, and therefore we need to do whatever Oliver says. We know from the UN climate panel that global warming will cause problems, but it will not by any means be the end of the world. It is one of the many problems we need to tackle, and that's exactly why we're having this debate, exactly asking, is this worth the money, or should we indeed do other things? And that's, of course, the other slightly sad thing, that it's a false choice. We can do everything. Well, we don't. And so my question to you is really very, very simply, how do you want to be remembered? Al Gore actually points this out very well. He says, this is our generational mission. He asks you, how do you want to be remembered by your kids? I find it stunning that he would actually make that argument, because the real question is, do you want to be remembered for having spent hundreds of billions or even trillions of dollars to do virtually no good 100 years from now? Or do you want to be remembered for actually having solved all the major problems that half of those world's population suffer, this medieval, terrible tragedies that we're watching right now? That's what tonight's decision is about. That's the trade-off. Thank you.
Summing up against the motion, Adam Werbach, global CEO of Saatchi and Saatchi S.
John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club, who founded it in 1892, said that when you pick anything up by itself, you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. And that hitchedness is what I refuse to let go. Mr. Lomborg, others say it's a choice, that we can either create green jobs, that we can launch a new Apollo project, that we can't do that and deal with poverty, global poverty, at the same time. In fact, we have to. And when you ask the question, how do you want to be remembered, I don't want to be remembered as a person who, to my three kids, as the one who saw a crisis facing us and who ignored it. More reductions in carbon emissions are worth the money. And many of the anecdotes we shared tonight are examples of how they are worth the money. And the reason we used anecdotes is because we actually have examples of how it's actually happening. Major reductions in carbon are worth the money. We're not going to do unintelligent things. We're going to spend it right.
For the motion, Peter Huber, author of The Bottomless Well and a columnist for Forbes.
Well, now I am done. I'm going to get personal and nasty, and I'm going to talk to you over there, and you, yeah, you know who you are, and also you. Like a medieval priest, you know, there are carbon brokers out there today who will sell you an indulgence that will forgive all your carbon sins. It will run you about $500 for 5 tons of carbon, which is about what the typical American needs, or about $2,000 per typical household. Your broker will spend the money on something good, most likely cleaning up hog farms in Brazil. But if you really want to make a difference, you must send a check large enough to forgive 4 Brazilian households too, because they can't afford that. So to cover all 5 households, the rich one and the 4 poor, make it $4,000. And you probably forgot to send a check last year, and who knows, some of you might even forget it for the next 8 years. Let's cover all the sins, you know, one backed this year's and 8 in advance. You'll feel so much better if you've already paid for these future sins. Let's make it 10 years, $40,000. Now, if you honestly believe that substantial reductions in carbon emissions are worth the money, you will sadly vote against the proposition. But then you absolutely must scurry right back home and send your check in, because if you don't, you will have burdened your already sooty soul with an extra 5 tons of self-righteous hypocrisy, and you can't possibly afford what it will take to forgive that. Your other
Your other option is to keep your money in the pocket and vote for the proposition. However desperately you may wish it were false, vote for, because it is in fact a true statement of engineering and economic and geopolitical fact. And vote for because acknowledging reality is the essential first step in trying to change anything for the better.
Thank you, Peter Huber. And with her 2 minutes to sum up against the motion, Hunter Lovins, president and founder of Natural Capitalism Solutions.
Boys, you've done a pretty good job of arguing what is essentially an untenable proposition. Why is it untenable? Because the numbers are in. Goldman Sachs, July 2 years ago, showed that the companies that are leading the way in cutting their emissions in implementing energy efficiency have 25% higher stock value than their competitors. The Economist Intelligence Unit last February, the companies that are leading in this have the highest, fastest growing stock value, and conversely, the worst performing companies in the economy are most likely to have nobody in charge of these issues. This is simply a better way of doing business. Now, you hold in your hands the future. You can choose to vote for the finest thinking of the 20th century, or you can vote for the future. You can vote to unleash this new energy prosperity. It matters what you vote now. We have argued, and I think we've proven, that cutting carbon is worth the money. We have not tried to argue that these investments will solve everything. We have also argued, I have, that these are the investments that will deliver genuine development to the rest of the world. So if you care about Bjorn's position, you will invest in these low-carbon technologies.
Thank you, Hunter Lovins. And finally, summing up for the motion, Philip Stott, Emeritus Professor and Biogeographer from the University of London.
Adam quoted a very great American. I'd like also to relate to a northeastern great American, in fact, the very founder of the American ecological movement, George Perkins Marsh of Vermont, who wrote Man and Nature in 1864, one of the greatest books ever written. And Professor David Lowenthal, also a great American author of today, wrote something about him which is extremely important for us to hear in the case of this debate. Environmental reformers who find nature's inarticulate indifference unbearable impute their own aims to nature and then purport to speak on nature's behalf. A reified natural world is then worshipped as virtuous. And Marsh himself said, the equation of animal and vegetable life is too complicated a problem for human intelligence to solve. I think there was a mighty humility in Marsh's view of nature, which actually we've forgotten today, which is vital. Because what I am interested in is outcomes. Will it work? Remember, the motion is major cuts. I'm really serious about this. We agree on the influence that climate change will have impacts on people. Of course it will. But what is really, in the end, going to work? It's got to work. That's where Peter's realism is absolutely essential to all this. And back to Johnson to end. He said, "Why, sir, most schemes of political improvement are very laughable things," he said, which I think is an important way of always looking at it. But finally, the limits of all that we're doing here. Also, Johnson, how small of all that human hearts endure, that parts which laws or kings or senates or congresses, I've added those, can cause or cure. In the end, we want to solve this because we think it's us. I'm afraid it's nature greater than us, and we can't in the end manage it as we wish we would. Thank you,
Philip Stott. And it's clear, given, I would say, the unusual level of passion that we heard in this debate tonight, that these panelists very, very seriously are vying for your votes and want to win. And now comes the moment when you decide. Here are the final results from your poll on our motion that major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. Before the debate, 16% of you were for the motion, 49% against, and 35% were undecided. After the debate, 42% of you are for the motion, 48% are against, and 10% are undecided. The side for the motion has moved More people changed more minds. Congratulations to them.
The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, presented by the Rosenkranz Foundation, was held at Symphony Space in New York City. Robert Rosenkranz is chairman. Dana Wolf is executive producer. Maureen McMurray and Rob Christensen are the radio producers. Damon Whitmore is the audio engineer. And I'm your host, John Donvan. For more information or to purchase tickets to future events, visit intelligencesquaredus.org. Intelligence Squared is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.